Hello and a very warm welcome to another episode of the Nosbriggs Parkinson's Research Podcast with me, Julie Jones. Many thanks for tuning in again to one of these marvellous sessions. So the last podcast, we looked at speech and language therapy in this series. So along with my podcast partner, Helga McFarlane, this time we are going to focus on occupational therapy.
Thanks, Julie. To help us through the topic, we're delighted to have with us a key figure in the area of occupational therapy in the UK, Claire Johnson. Claire is a senior occupational therapist specialising in Parkinson's disease at the University Hospitals of Derby and Burton NHS Foundation Trust, which is a centre of excellence for the management of Parkinson's disease. She's been a regular speaker at national conferences and seminars for many years and a member of the Parkinson's Disease Guideline Committee of the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence.
So thank you, Claire, for joining us today. We're delighted to have you on the call with us today.
That's not a problem. Yeah, I'm looking forward to having a chat and telling you about what I do.
Thank you, Claire. I suppose one thing that I'm very aware of, being a physiotherapist by background, quite often I find a number of the people I work with, people with Parkinson's, often don't actually get to see an occupational therapist until quite later on in their condition. And I think there's perhaps not always a full recognition of all the things that occupational therapy can provide for people with Parkinson's. And it is a very broad profession. So I wonder if a really good starting point for this podcast is for you can tell us about your role in the multidisciplinary team at Derby and particularly what sort of things you do for people with Parkinson's and your role as an occupational therapist in that team.
Yes, happy to do so. We're a multidisciplinary team in Derby. So we have links with the both elderly medicine consultants as well as neurology. We get referrals from both. Our multidisciplinary team consists of OTs, physios, we have speech therapy, we have psychology, dietitian. There is quite a lot of us. So we're very holistic. But yeah, as OTs, we try and get patients referred to us as early as possible. I think it's really important. We see patients at all ages as well. That, you know, one of the biggest things for patients when they're being diagnosed is the psychological impact that that diagnosis has on them. They really struggle with being given a long-term progressive condition diagnosis, and managing that has a huge impact on their physical function. So to get involved as early as possible to provide that education, not just the physical issues of Parkinson's, but also the non-motor symptoms that patients are really not aware of, coping with the way they're given their diagnosis as well, which can vary depending on how it's done and where it's done. You know, just being able to talk to patients about how they are dealing with that diagnosis. So yeah, we get involved with obviously a full assessment of their daily living, all their activities of daily living, which is a core element of occupational therapy, obviously. Fatigue and sleep is a huge issue with Parkinson's, so we will talk to them about how they manage that, how they manage their fatigue, which at all ages patients will struggle with Parkinson's just due to the nature of the lack of automatic processing. So yeah, you know, it's trying to get in there as early as possible, doing a full assessment of daily living, work, leisure activities, hobbies, you know, how they participate in daily activities, really.
So it sounds to me like actually it's quite a large coaching role and talking people through and giving them that sort of applied education. And you know, people maybe be familiar with the fatigue, but it's also then talking them through that. Is it a lot about giving them strategies? So what sort of, could you talk us through what you do to help them with the psychological impact or how occupational therapy can help things around fatigue and sleep?
So yeah, definitely. It's about talking through their feelings, getting a lot of information from them initially, you know, talking to them about goal settings, what do they want to get out of the kind of treatment that they're having. Because a lot of people just think Parkinson's is a physical condition. They've got a tremor or struggling with walking's not so good, balance is not so good. That, you know, they think that's all it is, but they don't understand that the cognitive strategies that we kind of taught them about will have an impact. So freezing of gait, for instance, has a huge cognitive element. and a very, very much an anxiety element as well. When patients become anxious about things, then their freezing gets worse. And even some symptoms like hallucinations can be have an impact by fatigue and anxiety and stress. So we talk a lot about mood, ensuring that they, you know, they're not experiencing low mood. If they are, then how they can manage with that. You know, talk a lot about managing day-to-day low mood, talking to them about how they manage their anxiety, what makes them anxious, what triggers their anxiety. We use a bit of a cognitive behavioural approach to that. So looking at some behaviours and how we can adapt or change those. But yeah, cognitive strategies are used in all aspects. So everything a patient does, whether it's getting out of a chair, whether it's getting in and out of a bed, is such a complex activity that we don't think about how we do. People can really struggle with it. So just a simple break down the activity, break it into different stages, different prompts, cue cards to get in and out of bed, something as simple as that might be all that's needed to manage that. So cognitive, the strategies that I tend to use are stop, think, plan, do. So if somebody's struggling to do something, tie shoelaces, for example, somebody with Parkinson's has not lost the ability to tie shoelaces, but there will be a day, you know, where they're really struggling to do that. It'll usually be the case where somebody's waiting for them, they've got a taxi waiting, they've got an appointment to get to. On that particular day, they'll find it really difficult to process that activity. And the more they try and do it, the less likely they are. So we say stop, take a deep breath, reduce that kind of adrenaline system that's kicked in. Think about what they are aiming to do. I'm just trying to tie my shoelaces, or we'll just go on an appointment or whatever. What is the aim? But first of all, plan how they're going to do it. And that might be, think of each lace, doing a loop or whatever. It might just be, right, I've just got to do my shoelaces before I go out. So that planning can be of different kind of depth, and then do it. So it feels like you're slowing somebody down, but actually you're just processing that information, because somebody with Parkinson's it's about mentally processing each thing that they are doing. And I think that's the education around that is really important, and also educating the carers or people with them as well, because they need to be able to understand what they can't see, the invisible symptoms of Parkinson's, really.
You mentioned the role of family members. That must be a really important part, when particularly when you're talking about people in their home environments. What does research say about that?
Yeah, research just say the impact of carers being aware of the non-motor symptoms is really important, because people with Parkinson's, as you know, you don't look any different. You're managing really well, and but every day is different, and some days that you can do something and some days you can't. And what is it that impacts that? And carers can become quite frustrated with that sometimes. Also, it's just natural if somebody's struggling with something that a carer or friend relative would automatically go in to help. And that's not always the best thing to do either, because somebody with Parkinson's sometimes just needs time, space to do something for themselves, and being helped is not what they need. But also, obviously, the support carers get, because they also live with Parkinson's. So it's about giving them, and that's what the research is more about, the kind of carer support, that assessment, continual assessment of carer strain, and how to support them, and what particular services are available to them.
I couldn't agree more, Claire. I think, it's not just about the individual, it's about them and their team, isn't it? And I think their team or their family who they relate to. And I think, the number of people I have coming through, and the wife will say, well, he walks normally for you, but he doesn't do that for me. And that's a classic statement I get, which we have a bit of giggling about, but I think it is. It's that making sure that everybody is aware, because I think, Parkinson's does vary so much over the course of a day, within the hour even. And just that recognition and understanding that is normal for both parties is really important.
Yeah, definitely. And also, as I say, I do see people at work. So it's about, work colleagues or employers particularly, I mean, work colleagues, patients don't always want work colleagues to know, which is fair enough. It's obviously down to choice there. But I think it's really important that employers understand the role of Parkinson's and what, you know, what's happening for the for those people. You know, it might just be adjusting their daily routine that means that they're just as productive at work.
Wow. I mean, I think that is. And I think that just again highlights the diversity in the role of occupational therapy. So not only is it a breadth of the type of interventions and treatments and management advice you can give, but also where you can go and help support those people. So it's not just about coming into the hospital to see an occupational therapy, you could see them at home, but also that you really have quite an impactful role about going to the workplace and providing advice and guidance about to employers and the individual about how they can optimize performance within that working environment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the biggest piece of research that done for occupational therapy does state the kind of four roles, you know, the kind of supporter, the networker, educator, and those kind of and then carer support as well. So we are very holistic. It's not just about the physical ability, it's about, you know, what's happening mentally and psychologically too.
Thank you for that, Claire. I mean, I think the occupational therapist that I have worked with, I think one of the challenges is thinking about the role of occupational therapy, because actually, to me, you're amazing problem solvers. You look at what people are struggling with and then come up with solutions or combine solutions with education and real practical, have you tried this? Have you tried that? And I'm always amazed at the sort of just the small things quite often that you can put in place, like changing the size of the pen or changing the grip of the pen. It's a really tiny, simple example, but the difference that can make to an individual and a really very practical guidance about strategies to help people maintain levels of function. But at the same time, also dealing with that emotional and psychological element, which really complements the role of other people in the multidisciplinary team as well. So it's everything, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. We are definitely. Yeah, exactly. And that's why we link so well in a multidisciplinary team. You know, we work really closely with our physiotherapy colleagues, you know, do joint sessions when it comes to things like freezing of gait or, you know, getting around the home or outdoor mobility, that sort of thing. But then we also work really closely with our psychologists in managing, you know, the mood issues, you know, low mood, anxiety. A lot of my work does involve, you know, talking to people or listening to people a lot of the time, you know, talking about what their issues are and what they're struggling with. You know, it's a major, you know, aspects of their life coming to, you know, how they interact in society and how they manage on a day-to-day basis and how they feel about that.
I couldn't agree more. And I think a lot of people with Parkinson's say those non-motor symptoms are often the ones that are the bigger issues than some of the physical issues. So I couldn't agree more. I suppose, can I just maybe change the conversation onto fatigue and sleep? That was something that you mentioned as an OT of a role in. Could you talk with a little bit more around, other than the sort of practicalities of getting in and out of bed and strategies for rolling, what sort of things that you found effective to help people reduce their levels of fatigue or improve their quality of sleep?
Again, it's back to education, first of all. So, you know, once they understand the role of the basal ganglia, the fact that it's basically their automatic pilot that's not working. So everything that they do on a day-to-day basis, their brain's almost working harder. So it's really about what we call routine management. We talk about their daily routine. We have a full 24-hour kind of history of how, you know, what they do on a day-to-day basis in activities and sleep. What we tend to find is that patients go to bed well, they go straight off to sleep because they're so tired, but maybe wake after a couple of hours only, and then struggle to get back to sleep throughout the night. So it does vary with everybody, but the reason for that is when we do sleep, we obviously go through stages of sleep. So the brain, if it's, you know, been working hard all day doing everyday activities, then it really struggles to go into slow wave restful sleep. So when you do go to sleep at night, you go often to kind of low different stages of sleep, but then you go back up into REM sleep, which is where we dream. And you find that people talk about how they have very vivid dreams and, you know, can act out their dreams. And that the reasoning behind that is usually because they're fatigued. So it's looking at what activities they do on a day-to-day basis, increasing their activities, which is always a really good thing. But also it's about pacing. So having rests in the daytime. I always suggest maybe just a short rest, just in the chair or something after they've got up, dressed, washed, you know, washed and dressed, eat, had their breakfast, cleaned them after breakfast, have a quick rest then. But I also always advise a daytime sleep. 45 minutes is the best time. Certainly no longer than an hour, but in between half an hour, but 45 minutes is the ideal time because that's usually about the time it takes to go into REM sleep. People say, oh no, I can't do that. That's giving up, or that's missing out on something, or that's not something I'm used to. But it does make a difference, definitely. So, and then other things, obviously, like making sure you're drinking enough water, got enough iron, all of those sort of things. But yeah, it's the daytime sleep's a really, really important thing. And if people are working, it's, you know, can we look at your hours that you're working? Can you fit a bit more rest in? Can you work maybe longer days but have a bigger lunch break or whatever? But yeah, it's about pacing but increasing activity.
Blair, you're my favorite person in the world for recommending a daytime sleep. I can't survive without mine because I am a terrible sleeper at night, and I completely concur with absolutely everything you've said, you know, about going to sleep and then waking up an hour and 20 minutes later and then not going back to sleep.
Yeah.
The one big thing I struggle with when trying to, well, when basically moaning to the people around me is I try to describe, there's a difference between fatigue and tiredness.
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Can you describe that for me and I can play it to them? Because it's a difficult thing if you don't suffer from it to actually describe, but there is a difference, isn't there?
There is a difference, definitely. Yeah. And we could all be tired, you know, if we don't do anything, you know, if I've, you know, I had a, you know, sat down for half, for, you know, a couple of hours on a Sunday afternoon, I can feel tired, definitely. Fatigue is different because you can work through fatigue. You can kind of keep going through fatigue and then it'll hit you like a brick wall. And it's an all over thing. It's almost systemic, I would say, you know, fatigue. It kind of completely drains you of energy, both physically and mentally. It's something that kind of builds up rather than it just being a, you know, tiredness is, I say, you know, you just, if you, you know, we can, as I say, we can all feel a bit tired if we're not doing anything, but actually we would then have the energy to do something if we had a quick rest. But fatigue is something that affects how your motivation, it affects your physical ability to do things, it affects your thought processing, it can affect you cognitively, you know, to be able to kind of process that or whatever you're trying to do, really. So yeah, they're very much different. I don't know whether I've explained that quite right, quite well enough.
Totally. Yeah. A sleep doesn't fix fatigue.
No, not at all.
Fatigue requires time, mental space, and downtime.
Yeah.
You can be awake, but you need that just general downtime.
It's a 24-hour management of fatigue, I would say. It's you know, I think it's not just about resting. You're right. We need to, I mean, managing Parkinson's is a 24-hour job in a way. You know, there's so many different things that we advise that you do. And you know, things like daily stretches, daily walks, you know, as well as eating everything you should be, you know, eating well, taking your medications on time, having a daytime sleep, resting, you know, practicing your speech, making sure your posture's good, you know, all of these sort of things, almost impossible to do, to be fair. There's just too many things to do in a day. But, you know, it's about your priorities, isn't it? And what, focusing on what what you need to at that particular point in the day. And if at that point you need to just take some time and rest, then that's what you need to do, definitely. Because continuing, it won't do you any good. It will hit you at some point. And so, again, right from early diagnosis, soon after diagnosis, information advice about how to manage fatigue on a long-term basis is really important.
I'm listening to all that you've said, and our series of podcasts, you know, we're always looking into research into Parkinson's, and we're talking about evidence-based medicine, and we're talking about measurable outcomes. How on earth do you measure the outcomes in occupational therapy?
Yeah, it is tricky. It's tricky. There are different outcomes that we use. I mean, we use something called COPPM, which is the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure. So that is a way in which we kind of take data from people, you know, information about what they do on a day-to-day basis, because obviously everybody is very individual and we need to take that into account. You know, what activities are you interested in? What activities do you do? Are you at work? Are you retired? Do you play tennis? Do you bowl? Do you, you know, anything at all? What that takes into account what the activities that those individuals do. And also it talks about quality of life. How satisfied are you in the way that you manage those kind of activities? Obviously, then we talk about goals and how, you know, what you would like to be able to do. And then obviously it's about measuring those goals, how many of those goals have been met and to what standards. And then there are individual outcome measures for every symptom, really. So obviously we have cognitive measures. We assess cognition using things like we use the MOCA, but there's the Adam Brooks cognitive assessment, which is more detailed. There's a mini ACE, and people nationally will use different ones. There are anxiety measures, there are depression measures, there's even apathy scales, there's fatigue scales, there's sleep scales. You could get a scale for everything. So you could come up with lots of data. There's really no excuse really for the lack of research that we have that's occupational therapy specific. Obviously there is a lot of research around sleep and fatigue, but not particularly to do with functional OT, unfortunately.
So what would you tell me then? What would help me?
We have an inbuilt body clock, the circadian rhythm. And you say it's not a habit, but actually it's a very habitual activity. You know, the circadian rhythm is extremely habitual. So I would obviously talk to you quite a lot about your routine, 24-hour routine, what kind of things you're doing in the daytime, but also what time do you go to bed? What time do you wake up? What time are you waking in the night? Are you looking at the clock when you wake up in the night? Because our body clocks will wake us to look at the clock. So just so something as simple as turning the clock around or covering it up, or, you know, if you have an alarm, then you don't need to look at the clock in the night. If you are waking, you know, try and get back to sleep initially. But if you're not able to get back to sleep, then get up, move somewhere else. If you've got a spare bed, just go and try and relax in the spare bed, or go downstairs or go to a different room. Don't do anything in your nighttime hours that you would do in the daytime. So no kind of going on any screens, no doing the ironing, no watching anything really good on telly. You know, nothing like that, because again, your body clock will wake you to do things like that, because if you're able to do those sort of things. One of the biggest things is don't worry about it. Don't worry about not getting sleep, because it's a myth that we need 6 hours unbroken sleep at night. It's about how much rest we get within that 24-hour period. We also worry about who we're sleeping with, as in, you know, disturbing our sleep partners. So that's why sometimes using a different bed for part of the night can sometimes help. But yeah, don't lie in bed too long trying to get to sleep, but don't do any kind of activities that you should be doing in the daytime.
I have got one thing right. I've realised that having a smartwatch on, monitoring my sleep, was doing more harm than good.
Yeah.
I got rid of that. You know, every morning I would look at it and go, oh no, I only got 4 minutes of REM sleep and 52 minutes in total. And I realised that was doing me absolutely no good.
No. And mindfulness. I don't know whether you've ever, you know, tried mindfulness. Mindfulness is a really good tool, I suppose, to have, because it's about distraction of the mind, really. You know, some people use talk, you know, radio sometimes, you know, in the middle of the night, there can be some just drivel talk radio that's on that you're not really listening to, but it's distracting your mind. Some people use mindfulness apps, you know, think about the, you know, technology, the apps around that have mindfulness. We teach some mindfulness techniques as well that can really help. But, you know, one of the major problems for people not sleeping is because they're worrying about things, you know, anxiety. Anxiety can prevent you from going off to sleep because everything's a huge issue in the night, whereas less can be less of a problem in the daytime because we don't think of it as much. But, you know, when it's the, you know, trying to get to sleep, everything goes through your mind. So, yeah, mindfulness relaxation techniques can be very useful to use. Obviously, there's basic sleep hygiene, you know, making sure your bedroom's dark enough, it's the right temperature, you're comfortable, all of those kind of things as well, and you've not done too much exercise before you go to sleep. The wind down routine is really important as well, you know, what you do just before you go to bed, you know, and if you can get into a regular kind of wind down ritual, that's quite useful as well. Sticking to going to bed at the same time and getting up at the same time.
It's interesting what's lost on a podcast for all those that are listening, when Claire was gratefully talking through all the things that perhaps people do during the night that they shouldn't do in the night. You missed Helga's face sort of going, yeah, I do that. Yeah, I do that. And yes, I do that as well. So, you know, it's actually, you know, again, it really highlights, Claire, just highlighting these issues. And I think for a lot of us, that's just what we get up and do. And I suppose for people with Parkinson's, I find is actually when they're awake and they're feeling good, they feel the need to maximize that time when they're on. And, you know, I find a lot of people exhaust themselves in the morning because that appears to be their good time. And it is that balance and giving them the confidence to sort of think about how they can pace themselves through the day, which may actually help improve their sleep at night. But it's quite a different change in mindset, isn't it, to be able to make that jump. And some of the tips that you've given, you know, just in this brief call, without doing an assessment of anybody, a thorough assessment, they're really, really helpful to get people just to consider. And maybe making one change at a time could be quite influential.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, because the emphasis is so much on exercise and activity at the moment, you know, I find that, you know, people are so focused on being really active, and that's really good. You know, people do need to be active, definitely. But it's so important. You know, there's no point in being really, really active if you're not resting, because as Helga says, that fatigue will just kick in, and it can be really debilitating, fatigue can. So it's about, as you say, pacing and making sure that you're getting that rest in as well. I mean, increased activity does help fatigue management. It is part and parcel of it.
I think I demonstrated then how technology certainly can't be helpful sometimes by looking at my smartwatch telling me how little sleep I got. But in occupational therapy, are you turning to technology more?
We use technology, we use apps for things like mindfulness and sleep, you know, and relaxation and things like that. For quite some time, we used technology for memory aids as well, you know. With Parkinson's, the main cognitive changes is around attention and concentration. So that obviously that's the amount of information that you can take on. So quite frequently people will say, you know, you've put something down, can't remember where it's gone, or, you know, or taking medication particularly as well. So, you know, actually using it as your phone, and something as simple as just using your phone calendars and, you know, reminders on your phone for medication and appointments and things like that. So it's just something basic as that. We are using things like virtual reality now as well to help with, you know, activities. We're doing some research in the use of virtual reality to manage freezing of gait, which again is not just a physical thing, it's also about anxiety and managing, you know, managing that. So we, you know, we're probably not as high tech as maybe speech therapy, but I think we're definitely, we do use technology in that way.
Perfect. Thank you, Claire. So we had a fantastic podcast in October by Jennifer and Emma, who looked at sort of the mental health aspect of Parkinson's, talking about anxiety and depression. And we spent a bit of time today talking about sleep. You have touched on meditation and CBT, but I wonder, what's the role of occupational therapy in those sort of more cognitive elements of Parkinson's?
Measuring cognition is a big role of the occupational therapists, and in some areas it's something that's most occupational therapists are referred for, you know, a cognitive assessment. A lot of Parkinson's clinics like patients to have a yearly cognitive assessment if possible, particularly those patients who drive. So we will assess cognition, particularly areas like I've mentioned, attention, concentration, language, visuospatial issues as well. We need to make sure that we are looking out for or monitoring those kind of areas of cognitive decline. Mild cognitive impairment can happen at any stage of the condition, but obviously we need to kind of monitor as well for patients getting older and the more dementia type symptoms happening. And we do get involved quite a lot with Lewy body dementia, which is an atypical kind of condition, as well as Parkinson's disease dementia. And I think, you know, the sooner we can identify those sort of things, there's definitely lots of things that we can help with. So, you know, providing that assessment and not just a score, but, you know, a collateral assessment of daily function that'll give us an idea of how their patients are managing cognitively. You know, it's usually us that are the first to identify these sort of things because of the questions that we ask, I suppose. You know, carers tend to tell us things a lot earlier as well. And with Parkinson's, we have, you know, very high level, high functioning patients, and, you know, detecting cognitive changes is not that straightforward. There's an assessment that's out of 100 and, you know, patients that score in the 90s and still struggle sometimes on a day-to-day basis with basic activities. So just a score is not always the best way of measuring things. You know, it's about how people manage on a day-to-day basis with their activities. But yeah, once, you know, cognitive changes happen, you know, there are lots that we can do. We run, as you mentioned, CBT. That's more for kind of anxiety, low mood, but we do cognitive stimulation, which is really good for you know, somebody with more of the dementia type symptoms, you know, and we encourage carers to be involved in that. That can be done at home.
It's really interesting, Claire, because a common theme since we've been doing these podcasts for, you know, about a year now is actually, yes, the tools only tell you half the story. And I think that's really interesting because a common theme that's emerged is that the importance of having a multidisciplinary team who has that specialist knowledge in Parkinson's, and it's that specialist knowledge in conjunction with these tools that actually is what is required rather than any one of the, you know, rather than just the tools in isolation.
Definitely, yeah. Most definitely. Yeah, it's outcome measures can give you data, but they don't give you that kind of information about how people are. And, you know, patients come to us and they'll see an occupational therapist and then a physio or the other way around or whatever. And it's amazing how different they tell us different things and how much we get, you know, different stories, not conflicted stories, but, you know, how, you know, we get more of each story. When we've seen people separately that, you know, that oh, they didn't tell me that, or oh, they never mentioned that to me, or that sort of thing, because we are very different as professionals as well. And we do come from different angles and we do ask different things. So we do get a fuller picture if, you know, if more of the MDT is involved. And patients benefit from that so much. They get a full assessment is really important.
Oh, thank you hugely, Claire, for your podcast today. It has been absolutely phenomenal and you've done an amazing job of really championing the role of occupational therapists, not only where you are, but I think nationally, and really, mm-hmm. I think the audience really appreciate actually the breadth, you know, in terms of it's really all aspects of everyday life that you're involved in. And I think that's been a real eye-opener for us on the call today, but I think really will be for those that are listening. And it's just been fantastic to hear another person in the pod that's so passionate about what their profession can do to help make the life of people with Parkinson's better and to support them really to optimally engage with everyday activity. So a huge thank you for me for your time and all your wisdom today on the pod.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.